This episode is brought to you by Red Boat Fish Sauce. I love cooking with Red Boat because it's made with only two ingredients, wild-caught anchovies and sea salt. This premium fish sauce is made in Phu Quoc, Vietnam and bottled right here in California. You can find Red Boat at select Asian supermarkets like 99 Ranch, H Mart, and Tong Phat.
This is the first time I've ever done whiskey at 8 in the morning.
Is it 8?
Yeah. Well, I got Lagavulin.
Okay. Or that Cavalon I brought you. You have that?
Yeah, it's in the back of my mom's car.
Okay. But you just leave nice whiskey in the back of your mom's car. We're going to use this. You're going to use this in the... You should use this. This is like the opening... the cold open.
All right. So should I go get it right now?
Is it a nice bottle? That'll be giving me like 12 years.
Let me. You don't do 12, you do 30? 12 fucking Lagavulin 30?
18 and over.
Or you want the Glenfiddich 60? Hang on, let me go grab it.
Cheers.
Cheers. You know, this is one of the most nerve-wracking things is to sit with you because, you know, we just know each other so well and it's just so awkward to sit here and talk to you on a recorded podcast.
You're recording right now, right?
Yeah, it's okay. Recording. It's fucking... Right. Cheers. We're drinking Lagavulin. It's 8 o'clock in the morning. And this is the first time...
In Los Angeles, but I just got back from Saigon, so I'm very much on Saigon time.
Congratulations on all the success of Greatest Night in Pop recently. It is heartwarming to me and to all of us to watch and witness the journey that you've gone through with Greatest Night in Pop.
Thank you so much, Ken. And it's been also quite inspiring to see the journey of the Vietnamese podcast since the first time I was on the show, maybe 3 years ago?
3 years ago, yeah.
But thanks for having me on.
Thank you for coming. The idea of it, you know, I sat with you and Anderson to start this and the support
who's
and the love.
Anderson again?
Anderson Lay is our partner at East Films. And I had a talk with both of you and you guys are in full support and I knew that it was the right thing to do. Yeah, so thank you for that. I want to ask you about how projects like The Greatest Night in Pop come about. How do you get it? How does it get to you?
I'm really fortunate and privileged to have a group of producers that I work with a lot. Sort of on the top of that list is Julia Nottingham, who I did Be Water with, my previous film. And for specifically Greatest Night in Pop, this was sort of fall 2020. We were pretty deep into the pandemic. We didn't know what the world was going to look like. Julia was, eager to work with me on my next project. I was eager to work with her. And we were just finishing sort of the run of Be Water. And not knowing what the world was going to look like, not knowing when we could really get into production again in terms of shooting, we looked at projects that were archival-based. And so, it's a very practical answer to your question. Like, what are the ways that we can actually achieve a film given the condition of the market or at that state, the condition of the world. And also like looking at like what, thinking about the condition of the market, like what were people watching at that time? And, I was watching things that were very much rooted in the past, things that in the 1980s and 1990s, the time I grew up in. And, those things that again, during the pandemic were really familiar to me. And it rooted me in a time, and it was sort of the security blanket. And that helped inspire sort of why we did Greatest Night in Pop, because We Are the World is such a time capsule, right? That song and that era. And so Julia was like, the song We Are the World. And I was like, I know the song, but I was only 2 years old when the song came out. To answer your question, it's looking at all these different parameters and for me, I kind of consider myself genre and story agnostic. If you ask me, I mean, you were there when I was contemplating whether or not to do the project or not. If I was going to do a film about We Are the World 3 or 4 years ago, I would think you're living in a different multiverse because it was never on top of my mind. But I think the responsibility and one of the, again, privileges of being a filmmaker is that I can take a story that has nothing to do with me or seemingly on the surface, nothing to do with me and that I might not have a connection to and find that connection. And also a story that might just seem a bit conventional, finding that through line that makes it engaging, that makes it meaningful. And so, yeah, I mean, projects come to me at, you know, I've been very fortunate to have representation through CAA and my management company, Mosaic. And over the years, they've learned sort of the language that I'm trying to create in my work. And that creates a second hand where they come to me with different projects. But I always just tell people, please approach me with anything. That's not a free solicitation for people to reach out to me with projects. But usually, yeah, I like to, you know, read something. When something is put in front of me, it spurs my imagination and I try to find that connection.
But I guess we got to go back to an earlier step, even before Be Water, before you meet people like Julia, who is your producer for Be Water and Greatest Night in Pop. When we go back a few steps, for a filmmaker who's been around, you know, for a typical filmmaker who's done documentaries for 5, 10 years, how do you get to that next step of having a producer like Julia reach out and want to work with you?
A lot of it's luck. I would have to say it's, you know, I can give the example of Julia. My first film, Live from New York, played in London at the BFI London Film Festival, and Julia happened to be in the audience. Mm. And she loved the film, and she came up to me after the screening. Again, this is not a solicitation for people to do this. But she just told me she loved the film, that she wanted to meet up for coffee. And she had a long sort of filmography and deep experience in the film world. And I was a fan of, you know, I didn't know her at the time, but I looked up her work and I was a fan of a lot of past work that she's done. And so that kind of was, you know, there's... You can't plan for that. I suppose you create opportunities for yourself, and the opportunities help create more opportunities and give you this like space where like these type of serendipitous occasions can happen.
I think you called it planned serendipity one time with me. You actually said that with the group of us.
Yeah, I mean, there's like this concept where like flipping a coin is not actually 50-50. I forgot who I was reading that talked about this, but you know, depending on how you flip the coin, if you can create more than a 50-50 chance. And so I look at all these opportunities where I can maximize, these occasions. And I don't know where that comes from. We can maybe by the end of this conversation, we can dive into that. But I've always sort of lived, thinking about how to, and this is not the right way, and there's no right or wrong. And I've learned over time that there's things that you can't control, but the things that you can control, then you try to maximize that as much as possible. But over the years, especially during the pandemic, I realized I have less control than I thought.
When somebody's like Julia says to you, hey, I have this idea, or do you go to her with, hey, I got this idea, specifically for like Greatest Night in Pop, whose idea was that? Did she come to you with it?
Yeah, I think there has to be sort of a variety of approaches. Over the years, I've realized that for me as a storyteller, as a filmmaker, I work better when someone presents me with a concept. It could be like a sentence. And from that sentence, my imagination is sort of catalyzed. I always thought, and there's this, I think, myth of the writer director who has to kind of create things from scratch. And, you know, I followed this sort of rule in mythology for a while until I think I realized that I can take another approach. When I was living in London and I was happening to sort of go through Stanley Kubrick archives, and I apologize, my dog is here with us, Cardi, so she might make some noise. But yeah, when I was visiting the Stanley Kubrick archives in London, you know, going through like all his past films, I came to the realization that most, if not all, his films are like adaptations. They're not original works that he kind of created. And in his production journal, he wrote that when, you know, I'm paraphrasing here, when he read something, read a book, read an essay, the process and the act of reading it helped him create the world and imagine that world based on reading it, right? And so that's like a very different approach than I think most filmmakers are taught. And I instantly connected with that. And so I love being handed like a book, an article, or for me,
song.
A song, for instance, a story, a byline, just a log line. And for me, using that very minimal piece of information and creating something bigger and cinematic out of that.
And so she approached you with
that idea? So to answer your question, she asked me, you know, I answered earlier, she asked me if I knew the song We Are the World, and was like, yes, I know the song, but I was only two when it came out.
Yeah.
And she's like, well, you know, there's archive of the making of the song, and you should really look into how it was made because it's a fascinating story. And so when I read a few articles, and there's a book by David Breskin, that sort of like again spurred my imagination of like what this story, what this film could be, rather than just like a conventional music documentary. And when I read it, I was like, oh, this has elements of like a heist film, it has elements of like a cliffhanger, of a, you know, ticking time bomb, all these genres that I feel can really elevate what could have been a very conventional behind the scenes music documentary.
Which they have, right? Which there's,
yeah, they had like a, you know, TV special in 1985 that came out as part of the release. But again, and that again, that's how, why they had so much documentation of that night. But for me, I was like, there's many different ways to tell a story. I don't believe in the sort of this idea of the definitive film or definitive story. I think filmmakers or storytellers who claim to make something definitive, it's a bit arrogant, I find, because we all have different approaches and perspectives on stories. And I think we should be generous to all these different perspectives.
Yeah. And I think it shows up in Be Water because there's what, probably five known documentaries before?
20.
Wow.
I mean, maybe 20. Not well known, but there was 20 previous pieces. Bruce Lee feature documentaries on Bruce Lee beforehand.
This episode is brought to you by Songkhai Distillery, my only go-to gin company. Established in 2018, Songkhai Distillery is Vietnam's first gin distillery, founded by Daniel Nguyen, a Vietnamese-American from Southern California. No matter how many people I have at my parties, we are always pouring Songkhai gin. Songkhai gin is handcrafted in small batches and prioritizes using botanicals and ingredients that are native and heirloom to Vietnam. The result is a product uniquely Vietnamese in taste and aroma. Songkhai is now growing to include rice wine and traditional Vietnamese herbal liqueurs similar to Amaro. Songkhai prides itself in Vietnam, from the farmers who grow the fruits and herbs to the artists behind the artwork and design. Songkhai is a community effort of people who are proud to be Vietnamese and collectively embody the spirit of Vietnam. That is crazy. I always thought there was five and you were brave enough to make the sixth one, but you're making the 21st one. Yeah, so that it does prove what you're saying, that there's a lot of angles to approach
different stories, and there's no sort of one biblical way to approach it.
Yeah, I mean, if it's like if Oliver Stone said, "I'm making a definitive Vietnam War, quote unquote Vietnam War film."
Yeah, so you go and you take Julia as sort of like this prompt, and you run with it. What happens after that? You start to read up, and you're like, okay, I can identify all these genre elements, and you start to put it together, and you commit to it. And then what sort of happens after that?
It's a long process. I'm trying in each film. Feels like a different process. I'm trying to sort of codify it in many ways. I'm a huge fan of Steven Soderbergh, and he makes so many films, and just listening to his conversations and interviews, he's really found a way just to like hone down on his process, and that's why he can make so many films over and over and so quickly. And so I you know, read the material, I kind of intuitively get the idea of the film, and I write it down. I write a lot of notes, both on paper and on my phone, and sort of once I take a little time off and I compile those notes after some distance from it.
Yeah,
I think it's important to like take distance from the work that you do. Give distance to yourself from the work that you do, because it allows you to become have a different perspective. When you're writing it, you're the writer. But if you're like reading it immediately after you wrote it, then you're still in the mindset of the writer. But if you give yourself some time, you become the reader of what you've written rather than, and you, again, creating that distance between yourself as a writer and the reader, and you can judge it from a different perspective. So after I like, you know, have jotted down all these notes and ideas, I go back to it as more from an outsider perspective looking in, and that allows me to see like which things sort of hit. Because when I wrote it, it was very instinctual, which I think is really important for creativity, to kind of have that instinctual feeling written down first, because people tend to over intellectualize their choices over time, and then it becomes sort of creativity by committee, because then as more people come into the project and the universe of the film, you get all these different opinions and voices, but you tend to go back to what you intuitively, you know, chose in the beginning. That's not always the case, but I find that for the most part you can defend that intuition, that instinct in the beginning, and it's something that's pure rather than, again, something that is overly sort of like turns into groupthink or intellectualized.
So you're making all of these sort of like plot points, or not plot points, but you're like kind of figuring the story out and seeing what material you have. But at what point does like you get a green light from like the people who are like the main characters of this doc, right? Like the Lionel Richies or the, you know, the different players that are involved. How do you, I mean, it's like putting the horse before the cart. I mean, how does this all work?
I mean, in a bit of life imitating art, imitating life, I suppose, with this project, it's very similar to the process of how We Are the World was made. It's any creative endeavor is pretty similar. You have the creative side, which in the film, you know, part of the song was Michael, Lionel, Quincy to an extent. And then you had Ken Cragen's team, who sort of handled all the logistics, the production and things like that. And so I'm very fortunate to have, you know, Julia on my side and her company, Dorothy Street Pictures. And, you know, they go about kind of compiling the production team. We had the wonderful George Henkin, who we met, and then Lisa Stevens, who was our story producer. And they basically become my support staff, for the lack of a better term. But really, you know, collaborators, I should say. I kind of like present to them my creative vision, and then they find the ways to implement it pragmatically, right? So, you know, they'll create the list of names of everyone who was involved, I go through that list. It's sort of just back and forth where, like, I think this person's important to the story. This person is important to the thesis of the film. You know, we're not writing a book where a book you can kind of cast a really wide net and you can talk to everyone. But, you know, film is a finite piece of art. It's liminal in many ways. It's one of the few art forms that's restricted by duration and time, right? Other things last in their existence in a different way. And so because of that, you have to make choices. And as a director, that's your job, is to kind of make the final choices. So the team, the production teams, the producers, they present me with all these options. And we, you know, there, it comes down to deep collaboration. But the end of the day, I have to kind of make that decision based on, like, what type of film The Greatest Night in Pop, for instance, is going to be. Because, you know, there's a great metaphor that Hiro Murai talks about. It's a director of Atlanta and amazing director. And he was asked, like, how do you explain what a director does? And again, I'm paraphrasing here, but he said a director is like someone, you know, they're climbing up to an attic. They're on the top of this ladder and their whole crew is on the floor below them. And they're looking into this empty attic or this attic, and they're describing to the crew below what they see in this attic. And, you know, that crew has to sort of like rebuild that vision for him. And so that's how I see it. So it's like, I know these ideas in my brain and I can envision what the film is going to be. And my job is to communicate that with my crew.
And when I think about Greatest Night in Pop and the actual song, We Are the World, you going up to this attic, this proverbial attic, you're an outsider from the Black community, from the actual demographic age range. You were 2 when it came out. And we hear in Hollywood all the time about this, like, idea of, you know, if it's an Asian or it's a Vietnamese role, then it should be played by a Vietnamese person. You hear these creative sort of pigeonholes where if it's a trans person in that role or as an actor, we should be casting that. How did you kind of get over this idea that you are not part of that age of that We Are the World, and you're not part of, you know, this, you didn't grow up in that culture of the Black culture of these big heavy hitters like Quincy Jones and Lionel Richie, Stevie Wonder, but you managed to really get into the actual portrayal and really getting into it accurately from my point of view. Can you share a little bit about sort of this idea of being the outsider doing something, redoing something, recreating a piece like We Are the World?
I mean, I guess the question is in the context of like representation and who gets to tell what stories, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I'm a huge proponent of communities and individuals who have been historically marginalized and underrepresented to have the opportunity to tell their stories or be part of that story. I think it's not just a sort of a social trend. It is like, it's paramount to telling stories that are honest. I stay away from the word authentic and truthful because I find those are really strong words and not very malleable. I think we can somewhat agree that honesty is something that we should strive for in storytelling. And I think, you know, having individuals from that community creates that honesty pretty quickly. And again, I think for the longest time, a lot of communities haven't had the opportunity. And it's not, you know, there's this like moniker of giving voice to the voiceless. But America Ferrera, who I respect deeply as an artist and as an activist, she said once that it's not that, you know, you're not giving voice to the voiceless. these communities, these people have always been talking, but people haven't been listening.
Mm.
And I think that's a very important distinction, is that, you know, the Vietnamese community has always been talking. The Asian American community has always been talking. And it's not, we're not like bestowing them their voice. They've, again, the world, the society, the powers that be haven't been listening. And so, yeah, having that opportunity to find platforms and stories that allow people to, like the wider audience, to listen to what people are saying is very important. And just so we're not going too far off your question, I think, you know, I always enter a space that I feel like maybe on a surface level I might not belong to. Enter that world with a lot of humility and deference to the space and the people involved, and try to find that connection. You know, representation isn't always based necessarily on a representation of someone's culture, someone's race, someone's gender, but it's also a representation of someone's experience. And so my experience of We Are the World is through the lens of my parents, because they listened to Lionel Richie, they listened to Kenny Rogers, they had the We Are the World record, and that was my in. And, you know, filmmakers, I know many filmmakers nowadays, Black filmmakers, who are doing stories that are outside sort of the Black, you know, narrative landscape, and they're being attacked by saying, like, oh, why do you have the right to tell this story about this white man? And that question would never be asked, you know, 20 years ago of a white man. And so I do think there's a bit of a reckoning, which is important. And I try, you know me pretty well, Ken, and I'm not someone who holds any view in the extreme, yeah, in the absolute. There's a lot of gray, and I think the beauty in the gray of like representation, and I had a filmmaking mentor of mine tell me, you know, she's often, you know, she's a white woman, she goes into communities and worlds that she might not belong to, but again, she enters with a sense of humility, and awareness that she doesn't belong. But sometimes she said that it takes someone from the outside to kind of see the beauty of a world, of a community that maybe they haven't, you know, they haven't seen.
And so that is my curiosity about how, you know, these people like Lionel Richie or people at that level had the trust in you. How did that come easily? Or was it something that you had to work for to gain the trust of Lionel Richie, an executive producer on the show?
So just to clarify, Lionel was a producer, not just an executive producer. No worries. Do you want to take? Well, you don't have to. You know, I know you don't. This is a raw conversation, right, Ken? No editing.
No editing.
Yeah.
Unless you want to
jag Joe Rogan. and so
that's fucked up.
So, I mean, I think, you know, you stand on the shoulders of the work that you've done in the past in many ways. And luckily, I've done Be Water and other projects with high profile subjects. And that was my in. You know, Lionel, most generous person I've met, and just such a kind soul. He talks about it in interviews that a lot of people have approached him to do a film about the song, and but he said no. But when Julia and I approached him, there was something different in that, you know, through our previous work, that's how we gained the trust of Lionel and all these other collaborators. But it's something, it's hard for me to answer from Lionel's perspective, but that's what he's told, you know, journalists in the press.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that he would take the time to research the team, right, to see what they've done and understand what you're capable of,
It's a big thing. It's not luck. It's you got to create like a track record of quality, and you know, not take shortcuts. You know, because that's I know you go deep and dive into details, and you don't you never cut corners. If that's one thing I've learned throughout the years, is like to really, really drill down on all the aspects of if there's options, you got to look at everything. There's a history of documentary filmmakers going from docs to making feature films. Is this a path that you are looking into in the future?
Yeah, I mean, not to like get into the sort of like vernacular of it, but for me, documentaries are films. There's no separation. People think of, they try to put docs as a genre. It's not a genre. It's just a different format, I should say.
You're not directing actors, right? That's the
sometimes,
one big...
I mean,
oh, really?
I mean, there's recreation in documentaries.
Yeah.
You know, even there's scripts in documentaries sometimes as well.
Yeah.
So I don't make that delineation between what I would call, excuse me, like a fiction film and a documentary film. Because for me, it's like, what is the best vessel to tell a story? Like you know, we're speaking on a podcast, and I think long form conversation is a lost art form, and podcasts is a way to bring that back. And so that is the vessel for which you have created for this, for the, you know, the stories and the people that you want to talk to. This couldn't be a documentary. This couldn't be a feature film. I mean, sorry, I'm contradicting myself. It couldn't be like a fiction film. And so I think artists, you know, quote unquote content creators, that's a vessel too. A TikTok video is a vessel. And so what vessel is the best suited one to tell that story? And so again, my past few films I've decided documentary is the best vessel. When I come to a project where I think a scripted narrative film, fiction film is the best vessel, then that will be my next project. So I don't try to like confine myself to the boundaries of like, I only make documentaries, only direct commercials. Like, I mean, I direct commercials, I produce feature films, I've directed music videos. Like, just, you know, if someone came to me with an idea, I was like, that's a great podcast.
Yeah.
Then I would try to learn to how, or I would defer to someone like you, or pass it along to someone who I think would be the best person to tell that story to. So thinking about if I'm the best person to tell a story, and if I am, then what vessel do I want to build to tell that story?
Yeah. And it seems like a very agnostic approach that you have to form.
Yeah. Again, be water, right? It's just like, you've got to, shameless plug, but you got to be malleable.
Yeah.
Like, I think people who are very dogmatic and rigid, it's stressful and it's constraining, by the nature of the words. And so I found over time, and this is something that's come to me through transformation, through growth. It's not, you know, people, you have to really come to that realization. I think the pandemic has been very generative for me to come to this conclusion, or this like realization, I should say. There's no clear conclusion.
Yeah, no, I think I can attest to that. I think there's a rigidity that you know, 10 years ago when you know, over 10 years ago when we met, there's a sort of rigidity that you had. And I think over time I've watched you grow into a much more open and looser sort of way of thinking. I mean, I really have. I've seen it. And I think it's the difficulties of different life events that have happened that have really opened you up to things. We're not going to get into that, but I think when I think about your path to being more open, it seems that way. Yeah. So, but this idea of, you go back a little bit, this idea of like gatekeepers, you had mentioned it not so concretely earlier, but do you think that there are gatekeepers at the level that you play at? I think I asked that because it doesn't seem like you believe in that. And when you don't believe in it, you personally don't believe in it, there are no gatekeepers. But if you sort of like subscribe to this idea that, oh, there's this glass ceiling or bamboo ceiling, that there is gatekeepers. But I don't, I've never heard it come out of your mouth.
I mean, I don't believe it's a meritocracy. It's not a pure meritocracy by any means. And speaking about the industry of filmmaking and no, I'm totally a realist about it and that there are gatekeepers, but you know, it's all sort of proportional. Like if you make good work, that's not good enough, sadly. I don't think there's any field or industry where making purely good work or is going to get you all the way to or whatever you think is what you want. I think over time, you know, I was going to be a lawyer. I was sort of like in the political world for a bit. That taught me, like, you know, access is power, to be honest, and not to sound so like real politic about it, but access is power in all industries. And I've been fortunate to have access to certain individuals, to certain, you know, platforms. But I think about how I gain that access and you sort of reverse engineer that. It's like having good work is one prerequisite. But also having advocates for your good work is really important. I think patrons, the idea of patronage is very important, the things that we do. You know, I think for a long time I was maybe a filmmaker who was like, okay, I'm going to make great work. I don't care if people watch it. And that's not what cinema is. Cinema demands an audience. It demands a viewer. That's the difference between the concept of like a motion picture versus cinema. A motion picture is just a moving image, right? And cinema is a moving image with an audience. And so I've been really, really fortunate, like especially with my last two films where it had a lot of eyeballs on it. And in a way that's sort of like nourished me, and not in a way that it's the only thing nourishing me, but you know, we make art and films for an audience. And, you know, coming to that sort of realization has made it clear the type of films that I want to do that, you know, hopefully bring people joy and have heart in them. And again, are enjoyed by a wide audience. And sometimes that's frowned upon, I think, in the work that we do. But if you can kind of do it on all cylinders, like make good work and have people watch it, then that's very, again, nourishing for me. But yeah, to answer your question, certainly there are gatekeepers, and they're built upon like traditions and systems that are a bit archaic. I think there are a lot of different organizations and individuals who are looking to sort of dismantle these ways of thinking and trying to find different ways to create access for communities. And I think there's a lot of great organizations like CAPE and VALA and Gold House that are allowing those gatekeepers to meet with filmmakers who didn't have access before.
Yeah. You you talk about this idea of doing great work, and I feel like there's this cyclical nature of doing great work, and sometimes you might find yourself in a place where maybe you missed the mark. I haven't seen that yet with you, but
you're too kind.
I mean,
there's certainly moments.
Yeah. I'm sure it goes through your mind. Is there a pressure that you have internally to keep outdoing the previous one?
I just try to do my best, to be honest. And knowing that I've done my best and like tried my hardest, like that's the only thing I can control. I've lived a really privileged life where I had such wonderful art teachers growing up, starting from middle school. Miss Tripp is an art teacher that will forever be in my memory and has always inspired me. And I remember I had this photography class in high school, and I was just diving headfirst into photography. I didn't really have a background in it, and we did like a pinhole camera assignment, and I remember just taking a photo. We had the class was about to end, and I just had to find a frame to take a photo, and I took this photo of just like the back of a rear view window of a car, and like, you know, 3 days later we developed the film, and the photography teacher, you know, she makes a statement at the end of class. She's like, you know, everyone did a great job on the assignment, and there was this one photograph that just like really blew me away. And I had no idea that it was my photograph. And that like sort of sense of encouragement and recognition, I think, I don't know where I'd be without that moment in my childhood. Like I think it's so important for, you know, the work that teachers do to encourage young people to find their calling and realize that there is some sort of talent is important. So, you know, to bring that back to your question, I was fortunate enough to think that I was talented when I was young. I still question talent and if I have talent to do something. And when I make something and someone's like, oh, well, that's really good, I question whether or not they're being nice to me.
Yeah.
But at the end of the
day, that shows up in our relationship constantly.
Really?
Yeah, you're always questioning me. It's like,
I mean, Ken is like the most effusive person you'll ever meet. Like, if you want like the biggest cheerleader in your life, then Ken, and that's why he's created this podcast in a way. I don't believe anything you say. And that's helpful though, because I think skepticism,
yeah,
is important.
Healthy skepticism.
Healthy skepticism creates a sense of humility. Sometimes it's false humility, to be honest. Like, let's keep it real. But you always have to think that you can do better, but you don't want to go off and be like so arrogant about things that you don't want to get better. I think like failure is super important. Not always preparing yourself for failure is really important, because I mean, film is hard. You get rejected from film festivals, you get rejected for projects all the time. So if you think you're just going to knock it out of the park each time, you're sort of in for a rude awakening. And so I prepare myself mentally for failure and learn from that failure. But I think it's important for me to realize you know, you do the best in the process. You really enjoy the process. You love the process. And whatever comes from the outcome of it, you have no control over. And like letting go and surrendering to that idea frees up so much of the stress, so much of the pressure. Our friend Ocean Vuong talks about, this idea of an artist, like when they finish something, a writer finishes something, it's like creating, they just built a raft. It's their raft, but when it's finished, they set that raft off down the water and they can't pull it back. And that raft, that vessel belongs to the world, to an audience, to a reader, to a viewer. And that has been a really enlightening sort of metaphor for me, because it just shows that once you, because people often ask me, oh, if you know you could change something about your film, would you? And I was like, no, that's the best I could do at that moment. Tried, I worked my ass off for what was created. And in that moment, that's the film that I created. and maybe in the moment when I'm watching it later. I don't tend to watch my work too much after the fact because of that reason. I don't, you know, if you keep on watching it, you might be like, oh, I want to cut that. I want to cut this. But I realized, like, in that moment, that was what I wanted to make. Mm-hmm. And I think that's beautiful, too, like, when you come back to a film that you made a long time ago, because you're a different person when you watch it.
Yeah.
You might be like, oh, I don't want to watch the same thing over and over again. But even though the work hasn't changed, you've hopefully changed as a person.
You know, I if you allow me to, I want to share a few of my thoughts about, you know, some people have asked me in my life, you know, being close to you, what are some of the things? And they're very basic things, but they're, I think they're kind of superhuman things, because I've tried to do these things that I've watched you do, and they're buttresses that sort of propel you. The idea of, there's like a few of these things. I mean, talent is something that, you know, like that pinhole camera. I mean, I can't pinpoint that and I can't figure that one out. That's just a sort of a natural thing that I can't really attribute to anything, you know. But the other things I can, which is your consumption of content and your consumption of not just content, but your consumption of life, eating, drinking, right? The alcohol is the food that you eat, the music that you listen to, the films that you watch, the life experiences that you, the hiking, the walking, all of the things that you push yourself into doing. And there's this other side of, like, a few years ago, I had put on a Facebook post. I was going to Bangladesh for looking for something. And I was asking anybody if they had a contact. And you were the one person that shot me this contact in Bangladesh. And then I started to notice that about you, which is this idea of generously giving to the community and making sure that everybody establishes sort of these networks within the network. And I think that's like this strength that you've brought behind the scenes, beyond your creative talent and the things that you do. Can you talk a little bit about that sense of community building and where you got that from?
It's hard for me to pinpoint. I think my sister has always been a really generous and charitable person, and that, you know, she helped raise me, and certainly that's instilled like a sense of selflessness. But I mean, there's obviously like moments that I'm a very selfish person. And I try to like hardwire myself. And I think like sometimes I'm generous because it gives me a, you know, dopamine hit, to be honest.
Oh, wow.
But I think if that's the way you can program how to be generous to the world,
gamify it.
Yeah. in a way. But I try to be really aware of the actions that I take, maybe to a fault. But, you know, there's like this abundancy model that I try to practice, the idea that we should, you know, we're not fighting for like one piece of the pie. We're helping to grow the pie so it's bigger for everyone. And so like when I, you know, when I connected you with Misha in Bangladesh, there was no conniving nature. I was just like, you asked for help. And so I connected you with Misha. And it's just like I figured you and Misha would get along, which I think you did very well.
Yeah, we keep in touch.
You probably know Misha more than I do, to be honest now. Sorry, I kind of forgot the question.
Yeah, no, it's just like, where did you get that from? But you answered, it just comes from your sister Yang. And, you know, I see that. I know that she has this very nurturing side to her that she's passed on to you. And speaking of passing on to, you know, our friends and pushing these sort of connective tissue, you just came back from the Ho Chi Minh City International Film Festival. Can you share with me? Because I didn't, you know, I couldn't go, and you had asked me and Anderson had asked me. But can you share like what went on and your thoughts and tell me about what went down?
So the Ho Chi Minh City International Film Festival, it's a bit of a mouthful. It just happened last week, it's in April. And it was the first ever film festival held by the city of Ho Chi Minh, known as Saigon to many people. And it was, I used to live there for about 7 years. And to see like an event of that scale, it was nearly 10 days. You know, it took over all of Wenhui. Like, wow. All of Wenhui was just
decked out in red carpet.
Was film festival. No, not, you know, the red carpet was mostly in Leloi. And then Wenhui was for the public. It was something like you were like, it felt like the world, what the World's Fair would, I've never been to a World's Fair, but yeah. It felt like the World's Fair. Like, there was all these like booths and, you know, stages and screens. It was really magical. I've never seen anything like that. And
you've been to a lot of film festivals.
Yeah, I've been fortunate enough to go to like Cannes, Busan,
and nothing Sundance. Has been like that.
Not where it was like the central hub where the public and the sort of industry can kind of intersect. So like, huge congratulations on to the organizers, you know, Antoni and Jihua, Aaron Toronto, who you know, Anderson Lay, of course. And it was a beautiful event where you really saw international filmmakers, Oscar-winning filmmakers, you know, world-famous actresses come to Saigon, Ho Chi Minh City, to like, and a lot of them for the first time, you know, yeah, like
Tom Cross.
Our friend Tom Cross has never been. He took his family, and it was like really just magical. I mean, it was not to kind of give you any FOMO, but it was like once in a lifetime experience, really.
I don't get FOMO these days.
Okay, good, good.
I don't. No, I'm certainly testing don't. You.
You're getting JOMO, right? So
I do. I get
JOMO, but then I also fly back to the Sympathizer premiere for one day.
Yeah, JOMO, for everybody who's listening, is the joy of missing out.
And realizing that the place that you are in that moment is the place that you need to be or you should be. But anyways, I mean, it was a beautiful showcase. You know, Vietnam has had sort of like national film festivals, but because of a recent cinema law that was passed, there's cities can start doing their own film festivals. So that was a big sort of change of the tides.
Why did they change that?
I don't know sort of the background politics behind it, because they lifted this thing.
Before it was like they
it'd only be like sort of the national film festival. So now, because of the changing of the law, like cities can hold their own film festival. So like, I think Da Nang had one pretty recently, but this one was really big, and I had the pleasure of being on the jury.
Yeah, yeah. And what does that do to the film industry scene in Vietnam? Does it open up sort of like new ways of being for the way the government kind of approaches filmmakers?
I don't know. I can't speak for the government. I hope that the people who came to the festival look at the city as a place to possibly film, as a place to showcase their work, to exhibit their films. Again, a lot of the attendees had never been to Vietnam before. And so it just like, you know, it's a practice in tourism. It's a practice in cultural exchange. I hope it continues. It was a massive event again. And I think that they're obviously planning more, but it's hard logistically, but I do think, you know, the city government hopefully finds value in opening up to international filmmakers, but also in nurturing the filmmakers who are in Vietnam, which I think is really important. And one of the things that, you know, when I was living in Vietnam, which was really hard, was not having access to films, international films. And so with a film festival, you give a city that is growing so rapidly with a very young population access to films that played at Cannes, that played at Sundance, instead of just the same things that they're watching, you know, Hollywood studio films and things of the such. For me, it was a really positive experience. And I do hope they continue it.
Other than some of the highlights of the film highlights, what are some of the sort of the special moments that you experienced? I think on one of them, I saw you post Tom Cross, and Tom Cross is a Vietnamese American who edited and got an Oscar for Whiplash and La La Land, works with Damien Chazelle, right? And you shot an Instagram story of him recording a medley of the films that he'd worked on. And I thought that was such a cool thing.
Well, it's just a medley of La La Land. I don't think they... La La Land is like was a big hit in Vietnam. So I don't think they did it because he was there.
Oh, right. So that's like sort of like one of the highlights. Yeah, that you. But it was like that you shot, you know, you took a video of that. And I thought it was like really cool. But what other things like that kind of... in your memory highlights the days that you were with the Ho Chi Minh City Film Festival?
You know, Koreeda, the Japanese director. Yeah. I mean, you know, he's one of my favorite directors.
Yeah, you're a big fan.
And he did this 3-hour masterclass.
And you got to attend it?
I attended it, and, you know, full of young Vietnamese.
Wow. Did you get to hang out with them and talk to him after or anything?
Not really. After 3 hours, I sort of had enough of Koreeda. Just kidding. Yeah, I mean, the question, it was for me to like listen to the what questions like young Vietnamese filmmakers had for a master like Koreeda was really enlightening. I try to think of listening as I think it's like a more difficult action than talking, to be honest.
That's so like, interesting. Yeah, you didn't come in hot saying, "Oh, I took this from Koreeda," but you're like, "No, it's actually what the kids were saying and asking that's important to you."
Because I mean, it's funny, Koreeda. He's a funny guy, even though he makes pretty serious films. He's like, "Okay, we're gonna do a Q&A. Please don't ask me questions like, what does cinema mean to you? What, you know, ask me very practical questions about your projects, and I will help answer that." And that's it. Sort of like dispels the auteur theory, where like, you know, I imagine certain Hollywood directors would just and actually European directors would just love to kind of like wax poetic about cinema and philosophy. But Koreeda was like, you know, kind of
practical,
get to the point. I mean, I'm just curious, like, yeah, what is sort of the antenna between Koreeda and these young Vietnamese filmmakers? I mean, I could, you know, I've seen Koreeda speak before, so I sort of know, but it's hard for me to have an opportunity to hear what a young audience will ask.
And what were some of the questions? I mean, in a very general...
They weren't great questions. Just kidding. they were like, I mean, they were very specific to the projects that people had, like, one young woman is a documentary filmmaker, and she wants to make a fiction film about these kids, but she's like, what's the best way to approach it? And it's like based on their true story, and Koreeda's like, why don't you just make a documentary? Just again, going back simple. To the question of what's the best vessel to tell a story. So I think there, again, this like distinction and between documentary and scripted and fiction is sort of kind of a tired conversation, in my opinion.
Sorry for asking a tired question.
No, it's okay.
You and I went to the Sympathizer premiere on the Paramount lot recently. You know, before we get into anything else, I'm curious to hear what your feelings were when you first walked into the after party.
Yeah, this guy, Ken, just wants to know how the party was, not about the screening, about anything.
No, we'll get into that.
Yeah, I mean...
We'll get into the heavier shit after.
Yeah, I mean, the Paramount lot is somewhere I've been a few times. Greatest Night in Pop was actually the first film to play in the newly renovated Paramount Theater.
And that's the theater we were in?
Yeah, same
theater. Oh, wow, okay.
And so we didn't have the same budget that HBO and A24 had when we were, you know, they throw a really good party. So to walk into the lot and see it sort of like bathed in red, and having our friend Demon Slayer DJing and we end of Beau
Beau, yeah. And Brodard
and
and
Bedard. You know, there is something special in that. The Vietnamese took over Paramount for a night
yeah,
in a way.
absolutely.
And you know, Paramount produced like Breakfast at Tiffany's and a lot of films that,
I mean, that's as old school as you can get. Yeah.
OGs, right? And
OGs,
so
yeah.
for us, and obviously, you know, I speak us as a community to have the Sympathizer premiere at such, again, a storied place meant a lot. But also to see so many friends and colleagues who worked so hard on the film, behind and in front of the camera, it was really heartwarming. And I flew back to from Vietnam for 12 hours in LA just to be there.
Yeah.
And it was just, I wanted to be there for that moment, to celebrate Viet, who I know it's been a long journey to adapt his Pulitzer Prize winning book into what is now a, you know, HBO series on the Sunday night slot, which is my favorite night of television, that favorite slot of television of all time. So like, huge congratulations to him, to executive producer Kim Lee, who, you know, really brought it on screen. And yeah, it's a fun night.
Yeah, Vit's coming on, I think next week to talk about it. And I'm going to ask him this question. He was asked by Lan, his wife, to wear an Ao Yai 20 years ago. And I read today in a post that she's like, I asked you to wear it 20 years ago. July is our 20th anniversary, and you've never worn it. And he wore an Ao Yai from Thái Nguyên for the first time on the red carpet. And it made me think about you. And I am wondering if we're ever going to see you. And what's your thoughts on and wearing an Ao Yai?
I mean, I'm all open to wearing what people feel comfortable and what empowers them. I just haven't found an Ao Yai that I think looks good on me. I was wearing Asian American designers that night, Good Fight and Ludan.
Ludang, yep.
Ludan, yeah.
You were wearing Ludang and Good Fight.
Yeah.
Oh, what piece was the Ludang?
My pants. Yeah.
Got it, got it.
So I try to represent the community in my way,
Yeah,
right?
yeah, yeah.
So like a Ao Yai is how people represent it in their way. And so, you
So
know,
you just haven't found it yet, right? You just
yeah,
haven't
I'm
found a
not
design.
opposed
Oh,
to it.
okay.
I would wear, you know, Native American, just kidding. Sorry, this is my humor. Yeah, if I found, you know, I mean, Peter Doe makes really great Ao Yai. I just haven't. It just, you know, it has to feel right. You have to. I'm not going to wear it just to say I wore Ao Yai. It has to, again, what you wear should empower you and should represent and should make you comfortable.
Yeah, because I'm moving into that. I will wear an Ao Yai just to wear an Ao
Yeah,
Yai
Ken
now.
is, you know, we're not filming this one because he's wearing an Ao Yai right now.
No, I actually considered it just as a prank this morning. I was like, let me put this Ao Yai on and see what you think. There's a diversity of views of the first episode or the first episode of this series that's coming out. Can you share some of your thoughts about how you felt watching the first episode?
The Sympathizer,
Yeah, the
right?
Sympathizer.
I am a huge Park Chan-wook fan. I'm a huge spy thriller fan. I'm a huge history nerd. And anything that has to deal with Vietnam, I'm interested in. So I mean, I love the premiere. I just thought it was like high energy. Funny, dark, you know, self-referential in the best way. Yeah, I think it was sort of a pitch perfect adaptation of Viet's book, which is a very hard book to adapt. It's that book is very dense. And again, what's the best vessel to tell a story? I know there was like, I actually approached Viet a while ago to try to do a film adaptation. But I'm very glad that they did a series, a limited series adaptation, because I don't think a film would have done the book justice. And so, yeah, I mean, I think with TV, I approach watching TV differently than watching film, to be honest. There's a sense of when you're like watching television and you're, you know, you happen to like check how much time is left, it's because actually you don't want it to end. And if you're watching a film and you're able to check the time, it's actually you're waiting for it to end, which is a weird, wow. I don't know how that works. So it's like,
it's an interesting dynamic. Yeah. Yeah. I can relate to that.
Yeah.
That is such a real thing.
And so, you know, yeah. And this is set in, as a limited series. I can't wait for the rest of the episodes. And that's, again, just evidence of the storytelling and the production and achievement of the creators.
Yeah. What a kick-ass year 2024 has become. Grace Knight and Pop, the Sympathizer, you know.
There's, I thought you were going to say the Synthesizer. I was like, is that, that's the AI mashup of the Sympathizer and Greatest Nine Pop.
And Demon Slayer. No, what a tremendous year that
2024. It's only April.
Yeah, it's only April. But what else can we expect? Do you know anything else that's coming out that we can expect?
So I just have been attached to direct my first fiction film. I don't like to talk about things until they're sort of like in the can, to be honest. I mean, people were joking like that when Greatest Night in Pop was announced, they're like, Pal just pulled a Beyonce. and so I like that better because, you know, there's so many projects that sort of are marinating over time and you don't really know what's actually going to come out. And, I don't consider myself superstitious, but maybe this is a sort of a sign of being superstitious. I don't like to talk about it until, yeah, it's ready and people can actually watch it. But there are a few projects that are I'm getting into production with.
I actually want to end on this one. I think you and I are, obviously we have relationships with our mothers that are, you know, there's ranges of emotions and stuff, but I saw you on the red carpet with her and you posted about that. And I thought it was such a beautiful image for me because I love my mom and I get along with her so well. And watching you take her out, as your date, at the Ho Chi Minh City Film Festival, was a big deal. How do you think that made her feel?
You should have her on the podcast. You can ask her all about this moment.
What was your decision? Why did you do that?
There's like practical reasons. I hadn't seen my mom all week because of the festival. And I thought she would enjoy. She's someone who is a big admirer of pomp and glamour, I would say. And so I thought she would eat it up. She's never been in the opera house before, too.
Really?
Yeah, and that was surprising, but also not surprising.
Yeah,
and
yeah, yeah.
To have that opportunity to take her to the opera house, which is so iconic, an iconic emblem of the city, I was very happy that I could do that.
And is she openly expressing her emotions to you about how she feels about your accomplishments?
I mean, not so much my accomplishments, and I love yous are for white people.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So
that's why I'm bringing this up.
Yeah, no, I mean, she writes messages that are really kind and endearing on Facebook, and I wonder if someone else wrote it for her because they are very kind. But I feel from my whole family like the sense of pride, and I think before, I used to crave the actual words, but there's something more meaningful where it just, you know, it just lingers in the air when they don't say it. I can feel it.
Wow. And you know, your dad doesn't say it directly to you, but he tells me, you know, and...
You're his real son.
No, he tells me, at the after party, that at Greatest Nine Pop, he was like, yeah,
you know, and he just like sort of goes through a litany of things, of the things that you accomplish. And I'm thinking in my head, I wonder if he tells his own son this, you know, because does he?
He does not.
Does not.
And that's okay.
And that's kind of the beauty of our culture. I love you for white people. And the way that these indirect messages come, I don't know if he intends to tell me these things so I can tell you, but there's a literally like a litany of things that he's telling me. He's pulling me to his side and he goes, da 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 da, kitang Vietnam nai. And you know, he's like telling me this young kid, you know, his son, and he's just like, he doesn't name you. He just says this young kid, you know, can you believe this young kid? And it's just like a beautiful thing. But I'm like, I always want to know, like, how do you, you know, he probably, does he ever tell you these things directly?
And he's told me like once, or I think it's actually through you. Yeah, you're sort of the messenger of that. But no, I feel it now. And again, I think, yeah, there's a longing for it. I think we, as sort of kids who grew up in America,
yeah,
we have had this longing because it's what was shown culturally yeah. to us on screen in books. And I hope, you know, in our sort of approach to storytelling and telling stories of our generation, of our community, we can add value to that type of love and that show of gratitude and pride that has been overshadowed by a sort of Western model of saying I love you and being very vocal and, you know, there's different ways to tell someone or express love. And that's the power of the work that we do to kind of share our culture by any means necessary.
Short of saying I love you today, Bao. I really appreciate all the support, the firepower that you've given to our crew, to our community, and obviously especially to me throughout the years. And thank you today for coming on. I've been waiting a long time to have you back on the podcast today. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.